Now we have. Roy Zimmerman.
This is a national campaign.
All the candidates
have their campaign theme song. But this is our campaign.
Hope and change is what you voted for. Looking at you now, I know that you're wishing that your vote did something more. Moving forward, hoping that the nation would be freed from the hand of ignorance and greed. But you know the slogan always needed just one more word. Hope, struggle, and change. Hope, struggle, and change. Oh, there's trouble and danger on the road to justice. Keep my eyes open, and change will come, but it won't be easy. You know the civil rights didn't fall to us the moment Rosa Parks stepped on that bus. So many fought and died for racial justice before and after. And suddenly a ray of hope appears, but only after years and years and years. And only because of blood and sweat and tears, and yes, even laughter. Struggle and change, hope, struggle and change. There's trouble and danger on the road to justice. Gonna keep on hoping, gonna keep my eyes open. And change will come, but it won't be easy. Elizabeth Cady Stanton never saw a woman's right to vote become the law. The women everywhere now know the awesome vote she carried. And Stonewall didn't settle any fight. There'd been a lot of Stonewall since that night. But one more state just recognized the right of people to be married. Hope, struggle, and change. Hope, struggle, and change. Oh, there's trouble and danger. But it won't be easy. We gotta hope and cry, work until we die. We gotta plan and fail, spend the night in jail. We gotta really get pissed, resist to raise a fist. We gotta try to revolutionize. We gotta plead and need, suffer guarantee. We gotta sweat, no doubt, get the vote out. We gotta howl, yell, raise a lot of hell. We gotta educate and organize to keep our eyes on the prize. So asking any president to make fundamental change, that's our mistake. We gotta be a giant just awakening from its slumber. You know the moral arc of the universe is bending ever better, never worse. It's almost like the human race rehearsing for its big number. Sing with me!
Hope, struggle, and change.
Thanks for returning to Great Speeches and Interviews on Axis Sacramento and The Voice. I'm Steve Lerman. If you're just catching up with us, we're listening to Straight Talk about the Next American Revolution with Gar Opperbitz.
It is also possible, if the conditions are right, that we are laying foundations for something much larger that could be transformative. Now, that's the hard one for people to get their heads around. You mean us? We Americans might be laying groundwork in transforming ownership in a radically decentralized way, piece by piece, and beginning to develop a theory and vision I want to remind you what I said at the outset. I'm a hard-headed Paul who's run, managed House and Senate staffs and been in very messy political fights. Been there, done that, know about real politics. Now, returning to what I'm suggesting, you mean you're saying maybe historically we might lay the groundwork for a larger transformation over 30 years or so, building upon this emerging transformative, potentially transformative vision of changing who gets to own the capital, socializing the capital like co-ops in a radically down-home American way that doesn't end up centralizing everything, but also does change and transform who gets to own, that might be possible? Yeah, it might be possible. That's what I'm contending. Maybe. Who knows? And you get to spend your money and see what happens with the game. Now, that's how it's always done, right? You never know historically whether anything's going to change. You always are looking into the future that is not known. Now, my heroes on all this, you know, just to give you a little insight, and if you want to think about, you want to play this game? The chips are decades of your life. You don't play unless you understand long-term change. My heroes are the civil rights workers in Mississippi in the 1930s. They laid the groundwork without which the 1960s could not have happened. And you don't know their names. But that's where the hard work was done. I'm not saying the civil rights was not hard work, but I'm saying that potentially we are in an era where the possibility of laying a transformative possibility, whoa, did you say transformative? Yeah, system changing. That it is within the realm of human possibility that we are laying groundwork and could with intention, that means the person sitting in your seat and mine, with intentionality look to trying to build a movement to change the system in a very American, radically decentralized, powerfully democratic way that respects the traditions of this country, and it is different from any of the traditional, boring 19th and 20th century models. It ain't like the Soviet Union, and it ain't like corporate capitalism, and it doesn't look like liberal kind of holding the thing together countervailing. It may be very American if we so create it. Pretty utopian stuff. But the interesting part for me as a historian is that the emerging political economic context, in my judgment, for the reasons I gave at the outset, the decline of liberalism, the failure of the labor unions, the change in power, is likely to continue to give us conditions of growing inequality, growing pain, growing ecological difficulty, and more people waking up and saying, like the Occupy people did, something's really wrong here. And more young people who can't find jobs beginning to roll up their sleeves and saying, either we do it or it's not going to change. I think the conditions we're facing are not going to be resolved. And that nature of that particular kind of historical context is a peculiar one. It's not like a classic collapse where the Marxists thought there would be a revolution. It would have probably gone to the right, not the left. And it's not like the pendulum will swing, the liberal power will come again. It is a decaying, stagnating kind of context like we are beginning to experience. Now, talk to young people or feel it yourself as the walkers begin to get you. It is a period where people really begin to say something's going on here. This was not the way it was supposed to be. This is the richest country in the history of the world. And people begin to say either there's a new path forward or it's going to get worse. Now remember, I look at it as a historian. The possibility, I think the argument of this book is we enter an era where the real possibility, not the abstract possibility, this drives people crazy. I'm saying real possibility of systematically laying the foundations for a possible transformation are with us. And that is it's our responsibility to look at that and say, hey, maybe we could actually do this if we got serious. I'm talking to the person in your chair, you know. That if with intention we were actually to get serious, we might be able to get ourselves to the place where we thought we might be even able to act as historically as the civil rights kids in Mississippi and see themselves as historic actors transforming the system. Does that ever happen? Well, you know, the Berlin Wall did fall, Soviet Union collapsed, apartheid did collapse, a bunch of small farmers and kind of small merchants and took on the biggest empire in the history of the world, the British Empire, and kind of outgunned 1,000 to 1. Things happen. Maybe sometimes. I'm not an inevitabilist. I don't believe anything's inevitable, including I don't believe it's inevitable that they will continue to control everything as they are now. That we are taught to believe nothing can change. That's a theory of inevitability. But it is possible also that merely what will happen is we will do some usefully good things and help strengthen the society and help some people by building these things. That's also useful. But just possibly, what then might we do? What then must we do? What then can we do? The title of the book in various variations is that we will build a movement peculiar to American culture, radically decentralized, built on the can-do spirit, built on the community kind of sense in America, we are a decentralized country, that actually lays the foundation for something new, maybe. So the game is you get to try it if you want to, and you get to watch it if you don't, and we're all in that game together. So thank you very much.
So what happened to the Occupy movement?
The Occupy movement, you ask, what then happened to the Occupy movement? I think, if I may recharacterize, they came and went and nothing happened. Is that what you're saying, basically? So, as a historian, things like that are often what happens in the prehistory of a great movement. Explosions occur, and they are not, the society is not ready to take them on, even in a movement-building way, and they fade away. However, and the press doesn't cover this because we don't have a press, if you actually look carefully at what's happening in the new economy movement, I gave sketches, often what you will find is people who met each other in the Occupy movement and formed small groups that they would not have otherwise formed and are actually doing the kinds of things I'm talking about. But I consider that a preliminary explosion, a very important explosion, but it would be not surprising if that first explosion didn't disappear and leave something behind. There will be many, many more, probably much quieter, in my opinion. But I think that's my judgment, what happened to the Occupy movement, and some of it was very, very positive, in the sense that I've been going around the country lecturing and talking about this book. Everywhere I go, you find people who were not doing anything political. Hear me. They weren't doing anything political. And Occupy got them out of that mood into doing something, and they were struggling now. What you find, they're doing a lot of projects. Not all of them, but it crystallized those kinds of things. And very interesting in that respect. Yes?
Great. Joanne Horevick from University of Wisconsin at Whitewater. Universities used to be ways to decrease the amount of inequality in our society, to empower people in the lower and middle classes to achieve various goals. Now, what's happening right now is that we're creating a generation that is burdened by debt, $1 trillion of debt. They're indentured servants in a number of ways. And inside the university, as we both know, the number of tenure track and tenured professors is decreasing. We have a number of individuals who are highly skilled, who are working as adjuncts. And I'm wondering, are there ways for us to apply what you're saying about rethinking these institutions to the place where we both work, the university?
Right. So that's another sign of the crisis. I mean, the ridiculous costs of university that cannot be paid, the public could pay, but in fact it's all loaded onto the students in these outrageous, unbelievable debts. And the adjuncts who are rented. So I live in a university. I think that system is collapsing of its own weight, and I think it will collapse, and that there'll be a transformative possibility, or it'll just be decay in tiny, tiny fractions. You all know the term MOOCs. That's common to these mass
massively open online courses. I'm lecturing on those on Friday.
Yeah, which means 200,000 or 300,000 people taking a course around the world free. It's a wonderful achievement, but it's undermining the whole traditional structure of university systems. So I think that the whole model is going to be blown apart, and probably should be at this stage. How we get done research, how we finance research is not clear. No one?
But a quick one, co-ops, is a cooperative structure for education a possibility? Have you seen it anywhere in the world?
I've seen co-ops that are trying to do educational work, but I haven't seen university research, funding of research, down deep to... By the way, I did my PhD at Cambridge, and I've led the country to do economics. I went to England because the economics was so, in my view, bad there. How do you think Cambridge was started? A bunch of kind of dissident young faculty from Oxford hired their professors in those days. Little groups of students, they wanted to be taught, so they hired somebody to teach them. That's how it worked. And they couldn't stay in Oxford, so they went across town and built up Cambridge. So we may see kind of innovative things like that. I don't know, but the system is clearly in crisis.
Hear great speeches and interviews at Access Sacramento every Sunday from 6 to 8 p.m. or go to greatspeechesandinterviews.blogspot.com. And now back to the next American Revolution with Gar Opperbitz.
Sure.
You seem to indicate that a lot of our change came within the system of the two-party system, the paper and plastic system that we have right now, or Democrats and Republicans, or whatever you want to call them. In the 30s, there was a third large political party that was operating that was very much supporting civil rights. As a matter of fact, many of their members went to prison over it. It was called the Communist Party, and it posed a real threat to the Democrats and the Republicans. Can you talk about that?
Well, it's really interesting because if you demythologize and demonize the Communist Party, and if you go to the South, where the Communist Party was really important in integrating the black-white fights, and nobody else would have only touched the race issue. So there is a very great history of the Communist. There's also a really lousy history of the Communist Party. It was authoritarian, dishonest, and did not have the vision in mind that I would support. So
John Gates.
Huh?
John Gates.
Yeah, I do not like where the Communist Party was proposing, and still, you've got to say some of the guys who were influenced by Marxist theory and communist theory did wonderful things in the South, particularly very, very courageous in many parts of the South, and paid for it with their lives in many cases. Yeah, so I'm not a communist, and I don't like the Communist Party as it developed. But the possibility of a party that had a very open and decentralized vision and a democratizing vision that was different from that, or an educating vision, that might be a possibility as we emerge down the line and begin to build new models. And it's a different from what you're talking about, but I think there's got to be people who want to do this in some organized way. Sir?
Then. My issue would be the radio stations. I think they're relatively affordable. You go online, you can find scads of radio stations for $1 million or so, just all over the countryside. You could take talk radio that seems to generate itself. They're taking over leading radio station in San Francisco and Chicago, WGN and KGO, by conservatives, taking liberal stations and turning them into conservative stations. So it's ridiculous because, those are liberal markets. So it's very doable, very affordable, and it could create the message we need to carry out this other transformation. And by the way, in 1982, I talked a gubernatorial candidate into adopting the North Dakota State Bank as his platform in the state of Oregon. Uh-huh. That's a long time ago. And I'm totally a Mondragon supporter all the way. Maybe the city of Madison could do that. Maybe I could run for the city council and we could take over the banking and create a Mondragon or North Dakota State Bank mini just for the city of Madison.
I like the cut of your jib. But that's exactly what's happening. That is to say, there is in the city of Richmond, Virginia, Richmond, California, the mayor has set up a office to create co-ops using the. And I was in Massachusetts recently. Activists there asking, what could you do with city government if you were creative? City government has the power of eminent domain, and it's been used progressively in Boston, for instance. It's got finance, it's got procurement, could have technical assistance. It could be used for a lot of interesting things. And in Cleveland, some of that's been done. The Cleveland mayor is looking really good because he's been supporting this development, and he's not as dependent on the big corporations. So using the offices of the mayor, and I was in a major Tennessee city 2 weeks ago, and the mayor's thinking about doing this kind of stuff. It is very doable if you begin to see what is out there practically. It's very practical stuff. And then it has a very different vision of where we might be going. So, yeah, go for it. Maybe it's radio stations. Kayla.
Hi, I'm Kayla. I actually work for a progressive radio show based on labor in Madison, called Workers Independent News. I have two questions, actually. You frame cooperatives as a product of a necessity of the environment, building a necessity for a cooperative. What can people do if their head's above water, it's not dire yet, and they're employed, and they don't necessarily have all the means of protection to form their own cooperative? And then also, what is my incentive as a consumer to interact with a cooperative instead of going somewhere that might be cheaper and might get more value for my money?
So, cooperatives, I say many of these institutions are being formed out of pain and necessity. That's not the only way to do it. You can form them out of intention and ecological vision and cooperative vision, too. So, but what's given the impetus is that. So it would not be beyond your possibility to set up a big cooperative radio system. I'm not teasing. How do you think it's done? it's always done by some people saying, hey, why don't we do this? It's never magic. It's people rolling up their sleeves and saying, this is a good idea. I think we could do it. So it doesn't have to be that way. It can be done just out of intention, and cooperatives do better, and they do better service, and they give people a better experience, period. But necessity, meaning people beginning to think something different's got to happen, is not only physical and economic necessity, but psychological necessity. I can't stand this stuff anymore. We've got to do something better. There's a whole level, a cultural level, too. On the other one, the incentive is virtually all the ones I've described are equally good in terms of price and usually better in terms of service, plus having a community vision. So those are pretty good reasons for a lot of people to participate, particularly if you use that as a way to promulgate them. And that's what a lot of people are doing. They say, come, you know, that you can go to, I'm sure in Madison there are a lot, you can buy coffee from certain places that are peasant grown, but it's better coffee too.
Just coffee.
So there's lots of models, but part of the necessity is people really thinking something different's got to happen. I don't want to get into that system. So it's psychological as well. Way in back.
You frame this more for the United States.
Yeah.
But, I mean, the United States has a very small percentage of the world population. I know we're very powerful as a country, but that's just because of our cooperation, our military, our corporations. How would this translate, I mean, the rest of the world, like for instance, South America, where new change is happening now, and for instance, Africa, which is in dire straits.
So the question.
Do you think this model would reflect? I mean, we have to think more worldly than we ever did before, I think.
So the question is, how might these kinds of ideas apply internationally?
Yes.
And there are, let me say two or three things about that. The most interesting model in the world right now is Mondragon,
which
is 80. You all know. Mondragon is 85,000 people. Some of you know. Those of you don't know what it is. It's an integrated set of about 85 to 100 co-ops with a central operation that they work together. If one of them's in trouble, you get your job. You have guaranteed to work in the other one. It's a complex organization, highly successful. 85,000 people, highly successful, competing on the world market on major technical and high technical equipment, but also the stores and grocery stores and construction. It's all virtually like a multinational corporation, but it's all co-op. And so the interesting... What's that?
Workers' co-ops.
All workers' co-ops. Yeah, and it's, just to give you the flavor of it, the wages top to bottom in 85% of the co-ops are 5 to 6 to 1. Major corporations here are 300 to 400 to 1. Now, in half a dozen of the very biggest of the co-ops in Mondragon, it's a little worse, 8 or 9 to 1. So it's an extraordinary achievement. Cooperative, it comes out of a very special case. I mean, it's probably not replicable in here, but it's very important. The thing that I want to just respond to your question, I think there are applications of these ideas internationally, and you can find them in the Emilia Romagna parts of Italy, where there's another form of linked co-op, worker co-ops and so forth. But I'm very hesitant, both as a historian and a political economist, to say our model, or whatever I think our model is the model for other countries. I don't like to do that. I think it's imperial and it's presumptive, but also I don't think we know enough about what the conditions are in very specific countries. We don't even know enough about what to do here. So I'm hesitant about saying this model, much as I think something in the direction of this radically decentralized wealth-changing model in very, very American form is a good direction. I don't know if that's right for other countries. So I'd say take a look for yourselves, but you know your country better than I do. I'm cautious about Americans telling them what will work.
This country is at war with Germany. You can imagine what a bitter blow it is to me that all my long struggle to win peace has failed.
Just 2 hours ago, Allied Air Forces began an attack on military targets in Iraq and Kuwait.
Why do we fight these foolish wars, deployed by men as human as I? How can we kill ourselves and feel like we did something right? What gave us strength to pull the trigger, allowed us to care about who is bigger, who enabled all this pain? What is this lesson to suppress our aggression? What the hell? And what about the anger? Why was that created? Just to have each other fighting till we've been eradicated? If only we come together and let go of our flags, but we don't care until it's us wearing the dog tag.
Death in my hands, I pray for forgiveness, hoping that whatever God left long ago would come back. I turn my head and see my brothers in ruin, but what I really see is fate, because it'll happen to me soon. Why should I have to pay for what that bastard devised? I will kill a man in any battle you've organized. Land of the free, or so they said long ago. I guess That's why they send a draft, cause we're free, you know. Boys become men overnight in fear, landing in an area they know nothing about. Taught to kill and forced to hate, to be a machine and let go of all the feeling. Shoot the guys who are told to be bad, laugh and cheer when your task is done. Look at the body and take all he has, but don't realize he's just as human as you, a father's son.
How is this man's life more important than mine? For me to fall and his hands pulled away from my sanctuary, facing the blood I take through an eyesight. All I can do is forget the home because I'm here to die. How is this man's life more important than mine? For me to fall and his hands pulled away from my sanctuary, facing the blood I take through an eyesight. All I can do is forget the home because I'm here to die.
Now for something completely different.